Next up, we have Benjamin Van Voorhees. He's an assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Chicago, and he's going to talk to us today about internet-based depression prevention intervention for adolescents ages 14 through 21.
Thank you. Hi, Beth. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the McGill University and to the Douglas Center for inviting me to come speak and for Michael's introduction. I'm Ben Van Voorhees from the University of Chicago. I'd like to disclose a consulting relationships with Mevita Incorporation, Hong Kong University, Prevail Health Solutions, and the Chinese International School of Hong Kong. None of those relate directly to this any material in this presentation. And grant support is grateful acknowledged National Mental Health, Center for Disease Control, NARCED Foundation, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And I want to start a little bit of biography. How did a primary care doctor, I'm always an oddball at these presentations, get involved in mental health research and mental health and internet? And really for me it goes back to my experience as a young naval officer 25 years ago. And I observed how the American military often takes kids from very disordered backgrounds, puts them through a very structured experience with very little mental health service support. And actually it is striking how many kids actually substantially were able to move along favorable developmental pathways as a result of sort of natural cues in the environment and relatively little professional support. And that really has intrigued me since then. What can we do in natural environments with natural raters to actually move people along favorable developmental pathways in their communities? And so I'm really going to take a little bit of an atypical presentation model and really try to answer four questions. First of all, what are the advantages of a primary care-based approach for engaging youth with an internet-based preventive model? How do you actually build a primary care model? Could such a model actually work? Is there any evidence? And how might it be working if it is working? So we'll see if we can move through these. First of all, how do we go about sort of skinning this onion? We're a health services research group. That's my training. We use clinical epidemiology, internet behavioral internet intervention development and database programming, and we use behavioral intervention approaches. We use a standard FDA model. This is more of a physician-centered model where we go through phase one pilot studies to phase two, dose and feasibility to phase three efficacy, and then phase four effectiveness studies. And then what we're trying to do is have a transaction between the database programming, the behavioral intervention development, from the learning from the trials going back and forth in kind of a synergistic arrangement. So the first question is, what are the advantages of a primary care-based approach? Well, actually, I started out in primary care. I actually practiced for 6 years in a small, rural, semi-rural community in the American South. And I recognized very early on that you had a lot of influential power with families. I recognized the power of families to influence the mental health of children, and I recognized the fact that really you essentially were their first resort for advice on child rearing and health problems. At the same time that this was going on, the internet revolution was beginning to occur, and it was striking to me that things that had bricks and clicks that had sort of something grounding in the community worked better in a commercial model, and I wondered whether they might work better in a mental health model as well. And so what are the kind of structural advantages to a primary care-based approach? First of all, we have access to the population at risk. We see most adolescents an average of 1.5 times a year. We have established caring relationships. My wife says I'm crazy, but I think that many of us do have caring relationships that manifest many of the traditional Rogerian variables of empathy and engagement and warmth. We have an easy, relatively existent distribution system that's throughout the United States and in most developed countries. We're culturally acceptable. We're not tarnished with the idea that we're some sort of a stigmatized provider. We're relatively low cost within the healthcare system. And actually, the role of physicians, primary care physicians, being involved in mental health or even preventive mental health has actually been endorsed now by multiple organizations. And it's now a recommendation, in fact, that all adolescents be screened for depression in primary care. So how do you go about building a primary care model? And this is an interesting and intriguing problem because we had to build a model for something that really wasn't in existence within the framework of either the primary care doctors or the patients themselves and introduce it to them. But we started that process by really trying to understand, you know, why would it not work or why hasn't it not worked? And really looking at the key barriers. And we identified five key barriers. First of all, to intervene to prevent depression, as Helen alluded to, is a complicated process. It involves altering multiple vulnerabilities. If you're thinking about trying to alter an adolescent's trajectory towards depression, there's going to be a burden. It's going to be a time-consuming operation to actually manage to change those behaviors. The interventions might actually be boring to many individuals. There's a physician burden. I learned early on that physicians don't like new technology in their office. They feel overwhelmed as it is, so you've got to be careful with that. And even if you could build such an intervention, what's actually going to motivate an adolescent? Helen alluded to this as well. The mildly symptomatic individual, he's not yet that sick to be driven through a behavior change program. So the first two I'm not going to discuss. For multiple vulnerabilities, really a different discussion. We use an ecological model. We map standard psychotherapy techniques onto this ecological model of multiple vulnerabilities. For adolescent burden, we obviously developed the idea of an internet-based program, and we try to use everyday language in a seventh-grade vocabulary. I'm also going to set that aside. I'm going to focus on the next three. I think they're a little more intriguing. Well, the first internet site we built, which was not the one I'm showing here, was what I would call a vitamin pill. It was flat HTML text, had no pictures, and the universal acclamation from students and adolescents was it was incredibly boring to do. And I realized we could never field an intervention like that again that didn't have any artistry or engagement. So the CATCHA 2, which you're actually looking at, the second generation intervention, attempts to use photography, art, and language to give a sense of lively engagement. But I think there's something somewhat deeper at work here, and that is we're attempting to use photography to actually convey, in a kind of a multimedia approach, some of the key messages. And if there's a key message we attempt to convey, it's really behavioral activation with the course of it. And in the course of this, we had a design team of teenagers and adolescents, and one of the interesting dilemmas we had was what kinds of people do you want to show? Visited lots of websites. I thought they would want to see lots of smiling, effervescent people. And what they actually said is they wanted people that showed a range of emotions and looked relatively ordinary. So the initial site we built was very ordinary and very like normal emotions, and we realized it was a little too flat, and we had to put some model-looking people so there would be some really attractive people in there smiling a lot. So the end result was sort of a mixed, hopefully media-savvy experience for the teenager. The fourth burden was physician burden. And it's one message I received when I was in primary care practice and attempting to do these interventions before I even got to research was that don't put a new computer in my office. I don't know where I'm going to put it. Where's the printer going to go? And please don't add anything more to my day. So the idea was that why not have the physician do what they do best, which is provide the relational experience, an interview to engage the teenager, and then follow that after they go to the internet site, come back and have this deadline experience of having to come back and talk to the doctor about it. But to move the behavioral heavy lifting somewhere else, to move it to the internet. So we use standard therapies. We use the individual coping strategy model built up by Clark and a group therapy model. We use the family-based approach pioneered by the Beardsley Group. We use the school-based IPT approach by Muffson and Stewart, and a community resiliency model by Bell, and we put them all in an internet-based format. The fifth problem we had was, how do you motivate teenagers to do it? I mean, my real terror when doing this study was that when we would open up the database, there'd be nobody in there. In other words, if you build it, will they actually go? I mean, they were going to go home from the doctor's office after a relatively brief encounter with the physician, and then you really were depending on them to go to the website on their own. Well, we believe there was a key health services question. How much engagement, how much time, and what form of doctor time would really be required to get these teenagers to actually go and use the internet site? And we believe that we could sort of dichotomize this into two possibilities. One, a patient-centered approach, a motivation interview based on humanistic psychotherapy. The doctor helps the adolescent develop their own rationale in a directive but non-interfering way, or the physician relies on a physician-centered approach, relies on their authority over the adolescent to recommend the intervention as a matter of a medical recommendation. One takes 1 to 2 minutes, very inexpensive, low training. One takes 15 minutes, we thought, and a relatively substantial degree of training, we thought. So the next step was, could such a model work? So we're going to get into a little bit of our phase two clinical trial results. Again, this is a phase two clinical trial. This is not an efficacy study. This is an attempt to understand what dose is required and is it feasible in primary care settings. So again, the study purpose was to determine whether a PCP motivation interview plus the internet site was superior to a primary care physician brief advice interview plus the internet site for key outcomes. And how did we go about doing that? We actually used something a little different than some of the other presenters. We actually tried to use a public health model. In other words, we said in primary care, when we have a disease we believe people are at risk for, we try to identify those at risk, stratify them for risk, and actually move them towards interventions based on their risk. So we actually set up and engaged 12 different practices in 4 different states, 2 regions, and that's 5 different health systems. That's 5 IRB applications. It took a year just to do the IRB applications. And we actually learned something interesting. We learned about 21% of adolescents could be found to be at risk for major depression. That is by virtue of having sub-threshold depression symptoms for at least 2 weeks at 2 separate gate points. And after we screened these kids in a public health structure, we then called them to assess eligibility. They had to be between 14 and 21. They had to have sub-threshold depressed mood. We excluded those with major depression, other primary mental disorders for the most part, and those with suicidal intention. However, we did not exclude those with suicidal ideation or self-harm ideation. So this is a modified consort diagram. We identified 103 kids who were eligible for the study, of which 84 actually enrolled. Again, they're randomized to 2 groups, the motivation interview group and the brief advice group. Motivation interview group, just to repeat, received 2 motivation interviews before and after, plus they received brief motivational phone calls in the same strategy. The brief advice group received 2 brief advice interviews plus the internet site. All the groups that accessed the internet site all received safety assessment calls. And what were the outcomes we looked at? We looked at, first of all, intervention, fidelity, and participation. Did they actually do the intervention? Did the doctors do the intervention? We looked at depressive disorder outcomes. We looked at self-harm, ideation, including adverse events. And we followed everyone up at 12 weeks, and we had 93% follow-up at 12 weeks. So all the analyses I'm going to present are intention to treat to 12 weeks. After 12 weeks, we have about a 75% follow-up, and those are per protocol. It's important to recognize that's a limitation. After 12 weeks, these are unpublished preliminary results. Up to 12 weeks, these have actually been published. So in terms of the sample characteristics of the group, this is actually about half male, half female, slight female predominance. It was actually 40% non-white. This is actually not a cherry-picked population. This included, as you'll see when we get to adverse events, urban youth, rural youth, poor Appalachian whites, poor rural African Americans. The median income for the kids in the zip codes they came from was about $40,000 a year, which is actually below the U.S. average. So these were not the typical upper middle class sort of ideal sort of psychotherapy patients. Mean CSE score is 24 in both groups, 24-25. So those are moderately depressed kids. About half had a family history of depression, as would be expected, and about a third already had prior treatment. And there were no significant between-group differences. So the first thing, what about fidelity and participation? Well, the first question for any sort of psychotherapy study is, was at least the motivation interview, the doctor part that was delivered with fidelity? And the first half of this table is actually just the physician interview. And there are 2 elements to that. There's the motivation interview rating scale. We recorded all the interviews, and then we had 2 raters rate them and then come to a consensus rating, and then we recorded the length of the interview. And what you see is essentially we subjected the brief advice interview to the same motivation interview rating scale because we were concerned that doctors would actually have bleed over. This was a within subject randomization scheme. In other words, each doctor ideally did 2 kids from each group. And what we determined on a 1-5 scale was the motivation interview group received a score of 3.5 versus 0.9 for brief advice. So it was significantly more in the motivation interview model. There was very little bleed over, and not surprisingly, it was 6 minutes for the motivation interview and 1.8 for the brief advice. Actually, it's surprising. I couldn't believe these doctors got through this interview in 6 minutes, but they've learned to be expeditious, and they did it. How about the adolescents? What did they do? So, interestingly enough, almost all of them went to the site in either group. This really shocked us. 90% in motivation interview, 78% in brief advice. But there was an important difference in terms of the continuous variable outcome. They spent more time there, 143 versus 90 minutes, and they put many more characters typed in, 3,200 versus 1,800. So the motivational group actually did spend more time, type more characters in. This is a little graphic. I only showed internet research groups. On the y-axis is time on each module. The x-axis is each module. And what you can see, the black line is a motivational group. The broken line is brief advice. And what you can see is that every module, the motivational group spent more time in each module. It's statistically significant up to module 5. And so it's not surprising to see a little bit of fade out, but it's interesting to see that it did seem to make a difference just in terms of time invested, even at the module by module level. Okay, the things we really care about. What happened to these kids? First of all, looking at a continuous outcome, depressed mood, CSD score. Again, the vast majority of both groups went to the internet site. The vast majority spent a substantial amount of time on the internet site. The y-axis is the CSD score. The x-axis is time going out baseline to 52 weeks. Again, up to 12 weeks is attention to treat, finished data. After that, it's preliminary data. What you can see is both groups experienced a significant decline in depressed mood scores down to the 15 range at 6 to 12 weeks. And then that actually persisted out to 52 weeks thus far. At least there does not appear to be a rebound back up again. How about if we dichotomize this data and look at clinically significant depressed mood, which I describe if there's above 29 above 29 for females and above 23 for males. And what you look at, what you see is from baseline to 6 weeks, you have about a 50% reduction in the prevalence of clinically significant depressed mood. And actually, that persists right out to 52 weeks in the data that we currently have. And there's no significant difference between groups, but there's a significant decline to 6 weeks. If we look at prevalence of any depressive episode, we use a different instrument for this. We use the Patient Health Questionnaire Adolescent. It's a current state questionnaire. We see a different picture emerging sort of subtly in this data. The black is brief advice, the gray is motivational, and what you're seeing is a similar pattern out to 12 weeks. Both groups have a decline in the prevalence of any depressive episode to 12 weeks, but that decline continues in the motivational interview group right out to 52 weeks. Essentially, there's zero prevalence of any depressive disorder at 52 weeks, but what you're seeing in the brief advice group is actually kind of a rebound back up to 10-12% range, which is what they start out. So you're seeing sort of a rebound in the latter part of the study follow-up in the brief advice group. This is actually self-harm mediation. This is any expression of self-harm of thoughts or events. And what you see, again, is a similar pattern. Going out from baseline to 6 weeks to 12 weeks, both groups fall about 50% with each measurement. It's significant for both groups together, a borderline for the groups individually. But you see something interesting. Actually, at 52 weeks, again, you have a continued decline in motivational groups. So actually, you have a complete extinction of self-harm mediation or expressed ideation. And you see a rebound back up on brief advice. And there's a trend towards significance in the comparison between self-harm mediation in the brief advice group and the motivational group. And this is our kind of final summative measure. This is a percentage reporting a depressive episode by 12 weeks. This is defined as reporting that they were diagnosed or treated by their primary care doctor, psychologist, or psychiatrist with a depressive episode since they began the study. And I have to say this was an outcome that was constructed during the study as a part of DSMB follow-up. And I can explain that a little bit further, but basically we construct that because we really realized we did need to track who was being diagnosed. And what you can see is that 1 year, the cumulative prevalence or incidence for brief advice was 28%. For the motivational group, it was 7%. There was a statistically significant difference between these two groups. In other words, brief advice was much more likely to have a depressive episode by 1 year. So other adverse events. This was really a group of kids that really represented the challenges of youth in the United States. One adolescent had a gunshot wound during the study. Two adolescents were assaulted during the study. One had an unplanned pregnancy. There was one suicide attempt at week one. And very unfortunately, we had one completed suicide at 20 weeks. It was about 15 weeks after he completed the study. It was extensively investigated, and it was found not to be related to the intervention in any way. The child had a prior suicide attempt and had a prior psychiatric hospitalization. We had a very inclusive sort of criteria. We did not exclude these individuals from the study. These are the more high-risk kids. We probably wouldn't make that choice again, but nonetheless, this is what happened during the study. The DSMB elected to end enrollment 83 out of 100 of the projected enrollment because they believed a trend had already been established favoring the motivational group in terms of valued outcomes, and that the other general endpoints in terms of establishing feasibility had already been reached. So the third good question is, what might be operating here? So in terms of just looking at kind of the group as a cohort and sort of ignoring the brief advice and motivational group, just rolling them all together and looking at internet site participation or baseline or factors such as motivation and attention, what seems to be associated with favorable trends in depressed mood or vulnerability or protective factors? First of all, baseline motivation and attention heralds future improvement. In other words, higher ratings of intention and motivation, rate improvement. Greater severity, actually, more automatic negative thoughts, lower self-efficacy, and greater levels of depressed mood appear to predict, actually, greater improvement. Ratings expressed during the course of intervention that the intervention was provided a good training experience and was socioculturally relevant herald future improvement. Passive dose, time on site, breadth, number of modules visited, depth, time spent on modules seems to predict future improvement. Dose active, percentage of modules completed in terms of exercises, number of characters typed in. Context, time of day, interestingly enough, kids do log on all hours of the day, but it appears to be only logging on during the daylight hours or early evening predicts improvement. Logging on in the middle of the night does not appear, time spent during the middle of the night does not appear to herald improvement. Similarly, this was brought up by Helen, is sort of a specificity. The sections related to CBT appeared to most strongly correlate with improvement, whereas introductory material appeared to have a relatively minimal influence on a subsequent improvement. And there's also sort of a time or temporal pattern that if you had improvement in the first 6 weeks, you generally sustained that for the next year. So we actually are in the process of completing a qualitative study of the intervention, which has been very illuminating what the kids did with this. But I had to put this as my favorite story, and it was not what I expected. So I changed five things about my life in the last month. The first thing I did was dump my lying, cheating, scummy boyfriend. I suspected he was cheating on me. It made me feel depressed. So she identified ABC method here, I guess to some extent. I found the girl and told her. I was definitely departing from the CBT script. Together, we took his stuff and dumped it out of our apartment. So it made me feel so much better. Actually, I was completely astonished when she told me this. It's an amusing story, and it's really highly paraphrased. And it's not meant to make fun of this really amazing person who just took the study and took it with and ran with it. I think is that we do not know what our patients do with these internet interventions, and I think that can be a boon and it can be a fearful thing. I'll tell you a more poignant story, and then I'll stop. We had one child that was enrolled. Both parents were substance abusers, and both parents were living in the area but no longer with their child. So there were presence in the sort of background of the child's life, living with his grandparents. And his grandmother told me, she said, he disappeared one night. He said he clearly went out the window. I didn't know where he went, but I think I know where he went. I think he went and visited his parents during the course of the intervention. And he said he kind of came back more settled. And she said, I think he was kind of checking out to kind of see what was really there. Was there something possible there? And she kind of felt that their relationship turned after that, that she was able to accept him, he was able to accept her, and somehow this child kind of came to terms with his life in some way that, whether it was by virtue of the intervention or the stimulus. But what it does say is that kids make their own meanings out of these interventions independent of necessarily the simple structure of the intervention itself. So limitation of strength, realistic primary care settings, this is a diverse group of adolescents, is a relatively feasible low-cost intervention. Important limitations. We lacked a full retrospective psychiatric assessment like KSADS to really fully capture disorder. There was no treatment as usual group, so we really don't know what a control group would have looked like. So in summary, the primary care internet model, it seems to be feasible in primary care. Adolescents had favorable changes in vulnerability sustained to 12 months. The MI group seemed to have a lower prevalence of depressive disorders and self-harm thoughts out to 12 months. And the MI group, the motivational group, demonstrated fewer depressive episodes. So I think what's the meaning for this area for internet-based research for prevention of mental disorders? I think I think the purely curricular methods, and I should say that I would sort of couch to say some purely curricular methods have failed to prevent depressive episodes, or I think there's a lot of variability in that, particularly school-based approaches. And one hypothesis I would sort of say is, you know, perhaps motivation is an essential conditioning needed before kids are exposed to a curricular approach. Maybe to accompany the coping skills to enable the kids to actually want to mobilize those coping skills when they encounter a provocative event. Motivation may provide the adolescent with a willingness to actually apply the coping skills distant from the initial learning on the internet. Now, I thank to all the amazing kids that have worked with me on this program. I want to thank all the mentors that have worked with me on the program. And just say that we actually, future directions, we're actually, of course, working on further studies, doing a catch-at-three intervention, but we've actually made the current internet site publicly available. We have several hundred users. Occasionally get calls from India and across the world, people, users, about the site. And if anyone's interested in whether it works equally well for African Americans, Hispanics, actually, their results appear to be quite comparable across ethnicity. Okay, sure. Okay, yeah.
Hi, I know you didn't have a control group,
right.
But you've obviously been around adolescents with
right.
low-grade depressive symptoms for a long time. What do you think the results would have been for the no treatment group?
You know, I think there's two factors we try to integrate. One is that, you know, and Helen mentioned this, there's a tendency across adolescents for a secular trend for depressed mood to actually increase with time rather than to decrease. And there's also a tendency within kids who have sort of sub-threshold depression, who aren't extremely high, which I tend to have the regression to mean, to sort of percolate along. So looking at other similar control groups, what I would say, a conservative guess would be about half the effect size we've seen, which is in the 0.7 to 1.0 range, is from the intervention, and half might be natural history. I mean, I think the most, hopeful interpretation was that the control group really wouldn't change, but I think when we're operating going forward in terms of planning for future studies, we're operating on the assumption that maybe only half of what we've seen is really intervention-related, which would be kind of a conservative assessment.
Would you say then that the control group would appear very much like the brief intervention group?
I think so. I think in terms
of... At 12 months.
I think in terms of the depressive episodes, probably yes. In terms of depressed mood, I believe that the control group would actually have significant would not have had a substantial reduction in depressed mood at 12 months, or at least it would have been more modest, basically.
And one more question, and that is, what CBT-based internet program did you use?
So this was the Coping with Depression course, Adolescent, by Clark and colleagues. And the reason we chose that was because it's been through three randomized clinical trials with a group-based format. And we thought it had the best evidence base. And actually, that's about to come out in the Journal of American Medical Association with a large multi-center trial, which is going to again show. Also, it's been used in Holland in the adult version. So we felt there was a coalescence of evidence around that method.
Okay.
Thank you for that presentation. It was really interesting. We have done a little bit of work with adolescents, so this was very informative. I was thinking about the motivational interviewing technique developed for addictions. Was it aimed to take up of intervention, deciding whether you should go for intervention or not? Or was it more of, yes, you have this intervention, now what's the pros and cons of doing it?
Well, you're right. It's a great question. So the first interview was built around a cost-benefit analysis of just going to the internet site. What are the costs and benefits? But we actually open the interview. We don't open the interview with a pathology focus. We say, what are your life goals? And then we say, how are you feeling now? And how is your feeling now impairing your ability to do your life goals? Now let's do a cost-benefit analysis around going to the internet site. When they come back, we repeat life goals, current mood state, but it's focused then around what's the cost-benefit of actually elaborating the coping skills you learned? What did you learn on the internet site? What's the cost-benefit of actually practicing those going forward? So it's future-focused around doing the coping skills you learned rather than doing the internet site again.
Thank you very much for this wonderful presentation. Did you say at the beginning that GPs are, or the health providers are by law forced to screen on depression for the adolescent group?
So there is now a recommendation by the U.S. Public Health Task Force on Preventive Services in the United States saying that primary care physicians should screen for depression routinely in settings in adolescents. So that will actually probably help us in future studies in terms of there being sort of a public mandate. The problem in the primary care setting is that there is an incredible curriculum for well child care that starts in infancy. I mean, I can barely get through. I mean, when I try to do an even infant care, it's like you're going through this unbelievable list. So the same thing is true for adolescents. So this is a challenge. It's a crowded curriculum.
Okay, and are they also obliged by law to provide an intervention?
No, they are not. The idea was that although there's limited evidence for adults that just screening helps, the thought was that because it's very difficult to identify depressed mood for many adolescents, to construct that understanding that was, and given the risk of suicide, that even though we don't necessarily have the care systems fully developed, hopefully the identification process would drive increased use of care. However, it did not address most of the kids that will be identified in this method will not have major depression. Most of them are going to be sub-threshold, and that's what we're hoping to fit into that system.
In the United States, the insurance companies are driving for a medical home, which includes basic mental health services. I know Aetna and a few other insurers are moving that way. So the onus is on the primary care provider to provide education and services. However, they're doing this not directly, but through their office staff, which could be anyone from an assistant, you know, a receptionist to a secretary to a LPN or a med tech, which is what's the negative impact, I feel, on the way it's being implemented in the United States. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's a very interesting idea. Let me just comment a couple of things. One of the things, a whole separate topic is actually putting this in a doctor's office and what happens. It's a natural phenomenon. And one thing we learned, one of the reasons we think we ended up with a lot of uptake in the brief advice group was the nurses. Because the first contact with this intervention occurred at screening, and the nurses actually became, or medical assistants became, actually very critical persuaders in terms of engaging the family with an interest in depression prevention. So in going forward, actually, I believe we'll actually be trying to sort of harness the motivational power of the nurses and the medical assistants. Speaking very specifically to your commentary, there was sort of an observation that the sites that had registered nurses were more effective in fielding the intervention than the sites that had purely medical assistants. And which is kind of interesting, kind of relates to your fundamental, you know, what is the lowest skill level that can be available to sort of have a persuasive, favorable pro-health influence? And I think that's sort of open for question. We will try to make use of those people who are available. We do not certainly believe that, an office desk administrative person should be providing health information. The question is, I guess, the boundary between RNs, LPNs, and medical assistants. And what can each of them provide in that medical home environment? Thank you very much.